All right. Welcome everybody here this afternoon. Nice tropical weather. And this afternoon we have this occasion to contemplate, reflect upon the subject. One thing that I have been the past week at the Leicester Summer School, which is a Buddhist summer school that meets every year at the Botanical Gardens at Leicester University. So I've been having kind of a holiday there. It's like a Buddhist holiday camp. I see some of the people. And this summer school, I find, it was established about 7 years ago, and it mostly quite mature adult people attend it. In fact, if you're 60, you're probably one of the younger ones. But also, I find that I really like that, because living with people who've experienced a lot of life, who've been, you know, had most of their life has passed, and they've had a lot of experience with the ups and downs that inevitably happen to human beings in this way. So in some ways it's a kind of common bond of understanding that sometimes you don't feel with young people, because they're still having to learn all about it rather than remember. And so just to kind of contemplate this realm that we live in as an experience, and because this is, we are emotional creatures. We're beings that we're not just kind of robots that just operate kind of automatically without just doing things and operating in efficient and rational ways. Even though many times we try to be like that, but the human realm is a realm of sensitivity. So it's a kind of continuous experience, isn't it, of being in this, in dealing with some form of agitation or irritation. That is what sensitivity implies. Just the human body itself, the sense organs, the nature of the planet that we live on, everything that we experience has an effect. Either it's affecting us, irritating us in some way or another. So it can be kind of, we have these words like irritation or agitation or aggravation, words that imply this something's always happening to us in some way. This unsettledness, this impingement upon our minds that is happening all the time, because this is the way it is, isn't it? The realm, the sense realm, it means that it's a realm where this is what we have to learn to live with, learn to understand it, learn to transcend it, if we're going to be liberated from just reactivity, just by caught in endless reactions to the irritations, frustrations, aggravations of sensory impingement. Because not only from outside do we experience this irritation, but also we create irritation with our minds. Minds just endlessly wanting something that we don't have, or not wanting something that we have. Always thinking that things could be better, even when things are probably the best, we still can imagine it being better. We create ourselves as a personality that we irritate our consciousness with. We're always looking or contemplating or thinking about ourselves in some way that is maybe worrisome. Something isn't good enough. We're not good enough. It's not, there's something wrong. There's something that we have to do, something that we haven't done yet, something that we've done that we shouldn't have done, and on like this, so that the human condition is a very strange one indeed when you think of it like this, that each one of us and each human being, all 5.4, probably by now 5.5 billion of us on this planet, caught in this state of sensitivity, consciousness, and inexorable change. This is this changingness is in Nietzsche, that relentlessly moving from this to that, from the beginning to the ending. And yet, in spite of all that, human beings experience a lot of happiness, joy. We can even through understanding the things that affect us, we can realize a transcendent relationship to this sensory experience. And that's, of course, what the Buddha was pointing to in his teaching about suffering, its causes, the cessation of suffering, and the way of non-suffering. Was a skillful means he used in order to allow us to see, to realize a way of responding and dealing with the ongoing irritations of this realm that we live in. It's interesting to see when you hear about or know so many people that suffer from depression. And this seems to be very, one of the common diseases in affluent societies is the experience of depression. And some people say it's due to various chemical imbalances, or one tries to trace it maybe as some kind of chemical problem, or is it merely emotional? And I don't really know myself on that level, whether it's due to some imbalance chemically, or whether it's merely just an emotional problem. And I don't think I've ever really been depressed in the way that some people have told me what depression is really like. So I'm just can only speak from my various experiences of being down, down in the dumps. Which have never lasted a very long time. I do remember when I was doing my examinations for my master's degree years ago in California, and I was very my nature in those days was very undisciplined kind of student. So I, towards the time where these examinations were going to happen, I would suddenly become obsessed with studying and stay awake nights and cram and read and drive myself to acquire more and more information for these examinations. So, and then in those days they used to have, this was before all the drugs were really fashionable, but I did find some kind of amphetamines that were mixed with some kind of tranquilizer. They were kind of green, heart-shaped pills. Somebody gave me these pills, and they're supposed to kind of keep you awake, make you intellectually sharp. So I started taking these green hearts. And so I didn't sleep very much, and I had this sense of being, alert. And I got through the examinations, past them, too. But then, suddenly, I went into depression. And it was a state in which I can say it was the only time in my life I felt that there was no hope, absolutely no hope at all, no possibility for anything other than misery for the rest of my life. And that was, I realized, was the aftermath of taking these amphetamines. Because obviously I could get I got quite stimulated and high. And then the result was a sense of, that's the only time I remember having that, of utter hopelessness, utter despair. And which means also in my life, I've been down in the dumps. I felt despair and world weariness and all kinds of negative states, but there's always a measure of hope that I could depend on. There's always, I never saw it as total or eternal. I knew it just seemed like that. You know, even though when you're in a state of despair, it does seem like your whole life is going to be like that. I mean, but I realized that was just how it seemed. But the effect of this drug, these green hearts, was I didn't even have that kind of wisdom. It just seemed total and utter hopelessness and helplessness. Fortunately, after that, I never wanted to take those kind of things again, because it was such, and even to this day, I remember, even though that was, 40 years ago or so, it's still, the memory of it is still vivid, and I never wanted to manipulate my consciousness with chemicals and drugs. And in the monastic life, of course, it's the discipline is one where you refrain from taking any kind of conscious changing substances such as liquor, alcohol, or addictive drugs, and you work with the consciousness as it is, just as an ordinary conscious state of mind. You're not even trying to get into emotional highs. Monastic life is really based on rather routine and ordinary things. So your experience of life is really around getting up in the morning, putting on your robes, eating your food, going on your alms round and doing things, quite ordinary experiences. It's not even like a meditation retreat where you sit for long hours, and refine your conscious experience through concentration. In fact, in Thailand, in Ajahn Chah's monastery, he was very much encouraging us not to even do much high concentration practices, but encourage a kind of ordinariness of monastic life, mindfulness and daily life that he felt was much more direct and useful than trying to develop the more extreme, more refined, concentrated state. And yet, for most of us Westerners, we wanted the high concentration state. There's a strong desire to live in a realm of bliss as a kind of permanent state of being. Because we hadn't really contemplated what it is to be a human being living on the planet. We hadn't really, we just imagined that we could find something better if we practiced meditation, or a state of mind that would be much more pleasant, that would stay with us all the time, and that once we got it, once we really managed to get hold of it, and it would stay with us, and we would spend the remainder of our life in a state of bliss. This was the hope that many of us had. But then in the monastic life, Ajahn Chah wasn't, he would laugh at these kind of aspirations that we shared, and all of our kind of, determined attempts to try to get these states. And we noticed that his life was very much quite a natural existence, where he himself seemed quite happy and joyful with just the ordinary flow of his life, of just eating his food, being with people, instructing the monks, walking in the forest, doing whatever he was doing, which was just ordinary stuff. He seemed to be a very joyful and relaxed and happy person, without having to kind of shut everyone out and control his environment to where he could attain a specially refined state of conscious experience. So this was quite an example to observe, because it did reflect, say, my own desires, because I dismissed that realm of ordinariness as just not being worth considering. The aim of being a monk, in fact, implied a kind of special, being a special kind of being, a special lifestyle in which you would be able to achieve special states of mind that you couldn't achieve as a lay person. The idea of being a hermit, being one of these yogis that you'd read about or hear about in India, places like that, where you know they could live in states of unmitigated bliss. You know, walk around, come stark naked in the snow, and still experience bliss all the time. It'd be really nice to live like that, covered with ashes and matted hair. I had quite romantic images of it, of myself, you know, just matted hair, covered in ashes. And yet, you know, this idea of being out and just walking around in a state of bliss and happiness all the time. But yet, life is not like that in this realm. I mean, through some kind of mental exercises, you can refine conscious experience, and through control of environmental conditions, you can kind of minimize the amount of coarse and negative and unpleasant sensory impingement through controlling. But inevitably, the come down is that we have to face just the pain, the unpleasant experiences of our own physical bodies, but also we have during our lifetimes all the as they say in the psychology world, the dark side of one's character manifests at various times in unwanted ways, usually. And so that this, even though one longs to be good and live in a state of bliss, be in communion with the ultimate, and have a pure heart, a pure mind, a lot of human experience is the experience of darkness or fear or anger, confusion and doubt. Anxiety. So many of these negative states are part of our human experience, and yet, you know, we can spend our lives trying to deny, trying to avoid, trying to repress or run away from these kind of mental experience, not to mention physical pain or disease. So I used to think that if I could just get into these refined states of bliss, then I could kind of bypass the dark side, you know, the bad side of life. I could just kind of sidestep it, and even if I lived to 100 years, somehow I'd avoid all that, because I'd be in this other state, which was blissful and pleasant. But then as I experienced my life as a Buddhist monk, I realized that that wasn't going to happen. That I wasn't going to get out of things. I wasn't going to be able to avoid the dark side or the pain or the fearsome and negative experiences of life. Because the Buddha pointed very directly to those very experiences as a noble truth. So the first noble truth of suffering is a statement, isn't it? There is this. This is part of our human inheritance. All human beings suffer. It's a normal, natural thing to do. This realm that we live in is like this. It's a realm of continuous change. It's a realm that tempts us, that we create delusions about, that is always in some ways irritating and impinging on us. And how are we going to relate to this realm? And of course, my previous relationship was avoidance, trying to refine the realm, control the realm, get out of the unpleasant side. But because of that, there is always a tremendous anxiety in my life. There's always this feeling of worry and sense of fear about, what if I lose control? What if everything gets out of control? What if the things that I depend on for feeling secure, safe, happy, that life is all right, what if all these things suddenly change? What if they are all taken away? What if I lose my health? What if I lose the people I depend on, that I need, that I love? What if I don't, you know, lose all my money? I don't have any money, and you can imagine the whole, you know, the all that is. Even when you're at the peak of saying having all the best, along with having all the best on the worldly plane comes the other, the fear of losing it. So in meditation, what Lungpa Cha would call meditation wasn't a meditation of avoidance or trying to control the mind, but in liberating the mind from fear and desire. So in order to liberate the mind, what do you do? If you're trying to change your mind, to make it into something that you desire, then you're still operating from the same delusion. So instead of operating from the same delusion, you change your attitude from trying to hold on to what you want and trying to control and protect all the things that you want and depend on, and try to protect yourself from all the negative, unpleasant things, to this understanding of suffering or the embracing of life. And so the Buddha was actually telling us, or suggesting, instructing us, instead of trying to avoid and run away or control, to embrace, to really open up to the full experience of being agitated, being frustrated, being irritated on just the sense level of consciousness, open, completely open to the experiences of aging, sickness and pain, death, loss, of despair, of anguish, of grief, sorrow, open to the experience of fear, jealousy, doubt, and confusion. So it's you're changing, aren't you, from trying to get rid of those negative states to an attitude of really embracing them, really looking at them, really feeling them. Because the suffering of life isn't really the conditions we're experiencing, but our reaction to it. We find, you know, the human being, we're very kind of tenacious and indomitable animals and creatures. We're not just animals, are we? But, or is that politically correct? Or maybe nowadays being animals is a good thing. But anyway, we have animal forms, don't we? The human body is an animal-type body. We're conscious, but we're not just animals in the sense of just instinctually intelligent, but we also have this reflective capacity. And in religions, in all major religions, they oftentimes refer to this kind of the combination of the earth and the divine, or that which is from the heavens above, which to me is the recognition of our ability to contemplate our own existence, our aspiration, isn't it? Why do we aspire to say finer things? Why do we want to be good? Why do we love the good? Why is there beauty? What is truth? What in most human beings is it that longs for truth and beauty and goodness? And of course, the cynics of the present day say, human beings, they just want, for selfish reasons. We want to identify with these things so we can feel safe and feel good. We can put it on a low level of just human arrogance and selfishness. But does that really ring true? To me, it doesn't. The goodness, truth, and beauty to me are pointing towards universality rather than towards things that arouse in me my most selfish feelings and desires. And religion in itself is always is pointing to a universal rather than just personal experience. In Buddhism, the aim is the realization of the truth, isn't it? The realization of Nibbana, rather than perfecting yourself as a personality, making it in the world, becoming powerful and rich and that kind of thing, which are the vanities of the world that deeply affect us as on the ego level, sense of our personal worth. But there's also in us something that doesn't want that really looks down and sees the futility and hopelessness of all vanity. And where is that from? Where does that come from? Now the human mind is, the Buddha in his teachings was encouraging us to investigate experience. And through this investigation, it wasn't analytical in the sense of based on a premise that you operated from, and some kind of basic dogmatic position. But it was on the experience of mindfulness, where the mind is in a state of natural openness, and it's not, and where we're coming from a place of receptivity rather than from a prescribed position. And so this is very confusing to most people, because most of our civilization very much encourages us to take positions, have very fixed views, opinions, ideas about life, about religion, about politics, about everything. You start from some kind of thesis about existence, and then you interpret your experience from that. But in the Buddhist practice of meditation, it's taking the experience of suffering, which is a mundane, ordinary experience, and investigating it, not on a personal level, but as experience itself, to allow this experience of suffering to be fully consciously accepted for what it is, whether it's physical pain or emotional anguish, whether it's physical or mental. So this isn't a doctrine that we operate from, but it is a truth, a noble truth that we're encouraged to use in order to guide us or remind us to do this. So that our relationship to the dark side of life, to the evil forces, to the pain, the sickness, the loss, to depression, to despair, and all of it, that all that is dark and frightening and unwanted and terrifying, horrifying to the human mind, then is, rather than rejected and denied, is open to. So the relationship is embracing. It's an openness to the dark. Now that can sound terrifying in itself, because we think that is, if we open to these things, and I was brought up with this very dualistic attitude. If you open to the dark side, then it would take you over, and you'd go crazy, or you'd be taken into some evil form, or you'd be killed, or you would die from it. But actually, that's not what happens, isn't it? If you start examining the dark side with this attitude of openness, acceptance, non-aversion, with a determination not to act or speak from any dark position, but to accept and feel and know it, then I found that the result of that is a kind of relief that comes from having, rather than reacted with resistance, a relief, a sense of relief that allows one's self to feel at ease with these forces, in which their power, their impact, and their power to delude is absent. And they fade away. They're naturally impermanent conditions that cease. And in the cessation of those conditions, you're aware also of the peace, the natural peace of the mind that is with us all the time. The stillness, the purity of that we can experience through consciousness when we are paying attention to life, when we're not just caught up in reactivity, in just blind reactions to the irritations and the impingement that we have in this throughout our daily lives. As we grow older, too, we have to deal with so many unresolved emotions. And in, say, in monastic life, for example, the when I was younger, a younger monk, I had a more willful approach to the life, because I was, you know, being male is one thing, being American is another. All these are kind of aggressive and willful karmic conditions. So you. Being young, male, and American. Being Leo, also. Being big. So these are, you know, it's quite a lot of power there, willfulness, and a strong kind of determination. Strong, very strong will. And so, and also I had contempt, a lot of contempt for weakness. And there's an arrogance to that also, a real arrogance that looked contemptuously at weakness. And there were certain emotions I could feel coming that I felt were weak. And so I would just kind of snuff them out, you know. Wouldn't, you know, I don't want anything to do with these weak emotions. And because I'm, you know, I'm too good for that. I'm not going to wallow in this weakness. I'm going to really go for Nibbana, full force. But that doesn't work. You end up feeling always frustrated. You think, you know, I've had several times I felt, I've nearly got it, you know. And it's that one slight weak moment, one heedless moment where I gave in to weakness, it all collapsed. And then I start condemning myself as not being strong enough, you know, and you have to be stronger. But no matter how much effort and how much, you know, how I tried to make myself stronger and stronger, that would always happen. It didn't seem to be a matter of strength. But what you can get out of just willpower based on the ego is very limited. And it only goes that far, and it doesn't work anymore. So then I started, you know, it became apparent that wasn't the way you do it, that this isn't what the Buddha meant by strive on with diligence. That's what you say at the end of the ordination procedure. To me, when I first ordained, strive on with diligence was that kind of bloody-mindedness that you're willing yourself to Nibbana. So then, I noticed that even the ideal of the forest monk, this appealed to this kind of very macho side of myself, where you know the tough forest monk out in the jungle facing the tigers, and that is, you know, it's a kind of adventure story too, where, you know, you those kind of fantasies are even, you know, promoted, because you do have this sense of, you know, really toughing it out. You know, life out in the jungle with the snakes and the tigers. Not letting malaria get you down and all the rest. Tarzan, I guess. But then the reflective style of Buddhist meditation is that you're observing the result. And obviously the result from just willfulness and force was very disappointing. You feel incredibly kind of like there's no way, you know, either you take it personally in the sense of I can't do it, or you use some wisdom and say, well, maybe I'm doing it the wrong way. And then reflecting more and more on the Buddha's teachings, you know, as through the experience of meditation, then I began to look at things in different ways. I began to see just my first interpretation, my first way of looking and responding to the Buddhist teachings had changed. I began to see it was much more profound than the superficial way that I originally interpreted it. So then the understanding of suffering, which is the first noble truth, suffering, understanding of suffering, suddenly this idea of understanding changed for me from being, I thought I understood suffering. Everybody knows what suffering is, don't we? We all understand suffering. Why make it into a noble truth? You know, everybody suffers. It's obvious, you know, grief, sorrow, despair, lamentation, loss of the loved, and you know that up here, you know, and it all, you think you understand it. You maybe know about it, and you certainly suffered. But to understand it wasn't an intellectual understanding. It was an intuitive understanding of suffering. So the Buddha was encouraging us to open that function, that attitude of intuition, which is an embracing conscious function of the mind. Because it's not an analytical function, it isn't a critical function of the mind, isn't intuition, is always here and now. It's the ability to open the mind in a receptive state to the present. And it's both in receptive to what you are feeling as an individual being, as well as the atmosphere you're in. Because when you allow yourself to intuit, allow your intuition to operate, then you're aware, you know, you're aware of particularly your own mood or the atmosphere of the place or the vibes or the atmosphere or the ambiance or the state or the mood, isn't it? But it's not critical. It's not a critical function. But it is an embracing one because it's not divisive. It's not cutting anything out. But it allows all that is present to be a part of that conscious experience in the present. So it isn't. It oftentimes seems very confusing to people. Like when you're trying to analyze and figure everything out with your thoughts, with reason and logic, everything seems so clear, doesn't it? You can put everything into categories and order it in 1, 2, 3 ABC style and computerize it. It all seems so neat and well packaged and on that level, we do love our ability to reason and figure and analyze our life and experience of living and the things that come to us in this life. But intuition isn't like that. It's not rational. It includes reason, but it's not rational in itself. So it's an inclusive thing. So just noticing how to deal with mindfully with experience. And fairly recently, I remember having a certain problem that there were certain people that I was having particular kind of emotional reactions to. Negative emotional reactions. And then there's the intellect of a Buddhist monk of over 30 years, which knows you should spread metta for all living creatures. and you should forgive your enemies and all that. I'm very well aware of that. And yet, on the emotional plane was a feeling of aversion and resentment and anger. So then the, this oftentimes, you know, creates confusion with people because they you know, they one thing on the intellectual side is very, you know, quite high-minded, wants to do the right thing, forgive and forget and spread metta and wish those people happiness. That's the grand gesture, the good thing to do. And then but there's still this on the gut level, this feeling of resentment, and oftentimes it can be quite, you know, quite really angry, wanting to, you know, get even. Now, intellectually, this throws us into, we tend to dismiss, that we can either dismiss the emotion and say, or condemn ourselves, thinking, what's wrong with me that I feel this anger? Why can't I just forgive? Why can't I, you know, spread metta and just forgive like that? Why do I have to feel like this, this anger, this gnawing resentment? And then the experience of mindfulness or this intuitive awareness, allowing for both to operate at the same time. Have you ever tried that? But it is, you do feel, you know, it's a kind of confusing thing, but it's like, I mean, but then the awareness is allowing for this interplay of the emotional reaction and the intellectual ideal without taking sides. And because they say an intuitive moment is embracing both, it's not taking sides, one, you know, for the altruistic side or the emotional side. It's accepting both and not judging. And then I found that the thing resolved itself naturally without me. In the sense of having done anything about it, but merely learned to accept it and admit it into consciousness so that both were accepted for what they were in that moment. And then it disappeared. Seemed to just kind of fade out. I was hoping it'd stay longer because I was quite enjoying the experience. So this is, and the Buddha did emphasize, you know, as his kind of focus, which is quite unique in any, you know, the mindfulness is the kind of main, is the way, mindfulness is the way you do this. And mindfulness then is, you know, we can, that word itself sometimes, maybe I was saying to some people the other day, it isn't a word that actually I used very much till I became a Buddhist. Before I became a Buddhist monk, we didn't talk. We said, you know, should pay attention, things like that. But mindfulness was a word that I don't think I ever used before becoming a Theravadin Buddhist. And then I didn't quite know what it meant. You know, I thought it was a kind of, I would connect it with various things. Like my first meditation experience was at a monastery in Bangkok where they did this Burmese meditation, Mahasi Sayadaw meditation, where you do everything in very slow motion. So you have to do everything very, you label everything that you're thinking, and then when you're walking, you're doing this very concentrated walk in a very slow way. And they said that's mindful walking. So at first I connected mindfulness with doing everything very slowly. So in order to be mindful, you have to be very slow. And then a few months later, I was at Samanera in Nong Khai, and I was at a monastery where we were doing this kind of practice. And the monk that was in the little hut across the way from me. It had been there about 11 months before I arrived. And I'd watch him, you know. He'd eat, and he'd just do everything so beautifully, you know. Each very slow motion was mindful and excruciatingly slow, you know. It took him, you know, he'd have to start eating his meal about 9 o'clock to finish by 12. And he walked and do it. But he'd been doing that for 11 months. And then one day I noticed an ambulance was there, and they had to rush him to the hospital because he hadn't been able to, you know, he's constipated and in a terrible state. And he just goes, I hadn't enough exercise. You know, mindfulness has to be, you know, some more practical than just doing everything slowly and premeditatedly. And so then I realized that was the kind of samadhi, a concentrated style. With Lungpa Cha, it was very much mindfulness wasn't a matter of speed, but an attitude of this awakenness in the present. And that was very much how he taught us always to, you know, to know what we're feeling in the present, to be aware of what we're doing, what we're feeling, what's happening. And then one understands that theoretically, but to do that takes years of constant reminding yourself to do that. I was in France a couple of weeks ago to see Venerable Nyanadaro, who's a Lao monk. We went to India together in 1974, and he has a monastery. We arrived in Europe about the same time, and he established a monastery in the south of France. And he's lived pretty much a life very much on his own and with a lot of meditation, more hermetic style meditation. And then I've been involved with this whole thing here in England for the past 21 years, you know, with monks and then nuns and then monasteries and branch monasteries and men going to Thailand every year, and, you know, just an endless kind of focus of so many people, having to relate to so many people all the time. And so we were talking about this. He said, you know, Ajahn Chah wanted me to, you know, he insisted that I live this, and he was talking about himself. My foot's going to sleep. He's talking about himself. He says, Ajahn Chah advised him to live a more hermetic life. And so that's what he's done. And so I thought, why did Ajahn Chah not advise me to do that? Because that's what I really wanted to do. And then we realized, you know, I realized that was probably what I didn't need to do, because I wanted to do it. And this having to open to other people, this kind of having to take on responsibility, having to be with people all the time, being the focus of attention, and being responsible were all conditions that I greatly dreaded when I was a lay person. Well, you know, there was something that I would have avoided if I followed my own desires. So I noticed that when I went to stay with Ajahn Chah, he would always kind of direct me out of, when I'd get into these very kind of, leave me alone, I'm practicing, he would pull me out of those situations and throw me into something that was irritating me. But you're usually doing things in groups. Work projects. And one time one year we were, there's this beautiful place in the northern part of the province there in Ubon, and it was completely kind of out in the wilderness. And a wealthy woman had offered to build a big pavilion on top of this hill if Ajahn Chah could figure out how to build a road up to the top of this hill. So I went with Ajahn Chah to this place, and we spent a couple of weeks there. And every morning he'd go out and he'd look with some of the village men, and they'd kind of circle around this mountain and look at various things, and they'd come back with ideas of, they brought engineers from Bangkok and all kinds of advisors on how to build this road. And it sounded like it would just be too expensive a project. But eventually, he found a way, a route to the top of this hill that would involve a great expense. And guess who would be the ones who would build it? The monks. So we all had to go there and build this road for about 6 months. Slave labor, like being, you know, like these road gangs you see in China or someplace like that. Where that So I ended up carrying rocks and things like that. We camped out in the open, and then we had to go on our arms round at dawn, and then we had to come back. We still kept all the monastic routine going. And then in the afternoon, and with the help of the villagers, we built this road. And I remember when he first asked me if I was going to go and help, my first reaction was, no, I didn't come here to build roads. I came here to meditate. I'm a serious meditator. Now, I didn't come here to do that kind of laboring work. That's the arrogant kind of graduate student. Sumato. But then I felt embarrassed by that. I realized I was being, you know, I wasn't very proud of myself for thinking like that. So I thought, well, I'll go and help a little bit and do what I can. And I went, and I spent there. I really enjoyed it. Whenever I go back there, I look at that road and I remember the good old days. It was a heck of a lot of fun, actually. And so that actually, you know, one of my duties, since I was one of the most stupid monks in regards to doing practical things, was the carrying rocks. and that was good for me. I had to spend hours in the afternoon carrying rocks from one place to another. And then the village, the town and village people were great. They'd come and they'd bring cases of carbonated drinks and ice, and we'd always be having these parties. You know, it was a real treat in Northeast Thailand in those days, where these things were real luxuries. To have like Pepsi Cola, iced Pepsi Cola was a real big treat, a real luxury. And so we were getting iced Pepsi Colas every day. And then the Chinese shopkeepers in the town would come out with really good Chinese food every day, really delicious Chinese food. And so the meals were good, and we had this kind of esprit de corps. Everybody was between the village people and the monks, and the Thai nuns would come and help cook food, and everything was just really this wonderful sense of everybody working together. Well, I never really experienced life like that before, in terms of such a large community working together. So it was a very enjoyable memory now. Well, I did learn from that. I saw that my first reaction was the idea of working, laborious work, out in the hot sun, doing something that I didn't think was terribly important. The idea of building this pavilion on top of the hill didn't even appeal to me. The fact that it was a wealthy woman who wanted to build it, I thought, well, just tell her to go keep her money and just... And if she really wants to build, she should pay for the road too. all my kind of views and opinions about it all, what I thought and felt about it, didn't seem to matter in the end. And, of course, it was a lesson in mindfulness, too. Both as I saw my own arrogance, my own unwillingness to cooperate, my own views about what meditation practice is, I saw all that kind of disappear and dissolve as I began to really appreciate Ajahn Chah's grander, more all-encompassing view of life that I found very inspiring, and which I've tried to develop in my own life. So here in Britain, for example, with this, like Amravati, or this was another kind of stepping out into an unknown area of taking on the responsibility of such a place, and yet there was a basic trust in through my own practice, and over the years we've been here 13 years now. The things that happen, being able to use my emotional reactions and my experiences as Dharma practice, rather than seeing Amaravati as something that's preventing me from meditating or doing what I think is meditation. It is meditation. So you're incorporating, your mind is opening, embracing, including, expanding, rather than becoming increasingly more narrow and focused on a particular condition that you want to hold to. So in joy and depression and with this sense of intuition or awareness, mindfulness, begin to trust your own ability to do this. I mean, it's not something that's difficult in itself. It's not like a very refined state that you have to develop under special conditions. It's quite a natural ability to, and we do it in extreme conditions, usually like when there's danger, in a dangerous situation, the intuition operates much more immediately than when our life is seemingly secure and comfortable, where we can get really neurotic, can't we, in the comfort of our lovely home with lots of money in the bank. We can drive ourselves into a mental breakdown. But when life becomes difficult, sometimes we're forced into this more total awareness. But as a religious path, it's not depending upon the external conditions, but on our willingness and our own determination to trust ourselves, to open up our minds to this embracing of both the ideals that we have and the emotional reactions we have, and to trust in our ability to sustain and accept what we're feeling and allow it to be what it is, and it will naturally cease. We allow things to go through live their proper lifespan. We're not trying to kill off or cut off anything. So this attitude is much more benevolent and patient. and open to life as we experience it on this planet in this form, and its irritating qualities, its challenges, its frustrations, its dark side. All this is part of it. You know, it's the way, the middle way is not separating from it, but embracing it. So I offer this as a reflection for today, and then it's now time for tea. Lada is very the usual dependable woman that always makes tea for these occasions, has it all ready for us. So I invite you all to have a cup of tea, and then in about 20 minutes, we can, if you want, you can come back and we can discuss this further.